I'm John Schumann, and this is Medical Matters, a limited series produced at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Today on the program, we explore nutrition as health and try to better understand how it is that what we eat has such a huge impact on our physical and emotional well-being. Our guest today, John LaPuma, is also known as Chef MD. LaPuma is a trained internist who spent an additional 4 years of training after becoming a fully-fledged doctor to apprentice as a chef. The results have been dramatic: 3 cookbooks, a website, multiple television appearances, and a concierge medical practice for which healthy eating is the cornerstone. He's currently running Chef MD Shorts on PBS, in which he tackles nutrition myths and gives tips on better cooking and recipes. His most recent book is titled Refuel. It's a nutrition book aimed specifically at men. Also on the program today, Gary Schweitzer reviews the week's health news, and Janet Pearson with a meditation on worry. First, this hour's news. I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. Today on the program, Nutrition is Health. We talk with John LaPuma, also known as Chef MD, about his decision to take his medical career in a very unique direction, that of chef, and to try to spread the gospel of better life through better eating. But first, with his weekly review of all the health news, is Gary Schweitzer on the line from his home office in St. Paul, Minnesota. Gary, this week we were going to talk about stories on screening, which is where we take asymptomatic people and try to find health conditions early with an attempt to cure them or treat them before their disease becomes life-threatening. You had a note about the Duluth News Tribune doing a good job critiquing some screening. Tell me what you found.
Well, I think this is really cool because, to begin with, they rise to the top because the Duluth News Tribune, I believe, has a circulation of only about 30,000, so tiny and lacking resources. And yet, the take-home message is the difference that one individual, this reporter, can make in a newsroom. So this guy, John Lundy, wrote a story which I think was based on just one reader's complaint, an old woman, I think she was in her 70s, who was upset about a piece of direct mail that she got from a company called Lifeline Screening, a company I know you're familiar with.
Yes.
And when she got it, she says in the story, "I smelled a rat right away." So this was a direct mail promotion for screenings for stroke, atrial fibrillation, abdominal aortic aneurysm, peripheral arterial disease, and osteoporosis. The mailing said they can help save your life. Well, the story went on very quickly then to quote Dr. Otis Brawley, who's the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society, saying, "Laymen would be shocked to know we actually do not have science to show that these screenings and early detection tests actually decrease mortality or are beneficial to the patient." Lundy went on to report that one of the healthcare providers in the community who had agreed to partner with Lifeline Screening actually ended that relationship after hearing from patients who were concerned about that sponsorship. So just like I said, the difference that one person can make in a newsroom, here apparently is a clear sign of what a difference smart news consumers and healthcare consumers can make by voicing their complaints to a healthcare provider who then ended this relationship. So one little guy in one little paper asking tough questions, and I think that's what we need to do with screening tests, where we often fail to explain that there are trade-offs. Something you stand to gain, yes, but something you stand to lose with any screening decision.
And for listeners that may not be aware, what are some of the pitfalls of these screening tests that, you know, at least are marketed via testimonial that, you know, this test could save your life? I mean, what could be the downside of more information, right?
Well, the wider you cast the net, the more you're going to pull in, yes, some things that you're happy that you found, but a heck of a lot more things that in the end you really wish you hadn't found, and which lead to overdiagnosis of conditions that are never going to make a difference in a person's life, but then they lead to overtreatment with things that cause even more problems with even higher healthcare costs. And in the end, people may often look back and say, "I wish I hadn't gone down this road at all." That's why it's important to ask the questions up front.
Yeah, and we don't get those testimonials from those companies, do we?
No, not often.
All right, so we're going to contrast the small-town Duluth News Tribune with the much bigger Philadelphia Inquirer, who is a major metropolitan area doing not such a good job with a story on the Don't Fear the Finger campaign. Tell us about that.
Well, and I was surprised because this is usually a good paper, and this was usually a good journalist. But the story was headlined, Prostate Cancer Activists Launch the Finger Campaign to Stem the Decline in Testing. So these were people who care about prostate cancer and started a Don't Fear the Finger campaign, the finger as used in the digital rectal exam, along with the PSA blood test to look for prostate cancer. But there wasn't any independent vetting of the evidence in this story. What there was a real imbalance in who was interviewed and who was allowed to say things in this story. So urologists, and this is their bailiwick, the prostate, were allowed to say things like one of them was quoted in the story saying, family doctors are confused about these guidelines, raising questions about prostate cancer screening. Well, why didn't we hear from any family doctors in the story? All we heard from were urologists, except Dr. Otis Browley, the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society, was quoted. And the story led into his quote in just about the oddest collection of words I can recall. The story said he's against screening even though he's black. Let me take the first part of that. I've followed Otis Browley's sayings and writings for years and years, and I have never heard him say he was against screening. And in fact, I usually quote him from a video that anyone can find on YouTube online where he says, I must stress, we're not against prostate cancer screening. We're against a man being duped and deceived into getting prostate cancer screening. So I have to question whether he ever really said that. And the second part of that, even though he is black, what is that supposed to mean? Is that supposed to suggest that this learned physician researcher would evaluate the evidence differently because of his skin color? Just ridiculous. And then finally, the real coup de grace was the final quote from another one of the urologists in the story saying, discouraging a simple and inexpensive blood test is not the way to address concerns. Whoa, wait a minute. I always tell my readers, anytime you hear simple blood test, run for the hills, because there's no such thing for reasons that we've already started to talk about here. And it was just one final mark of the imbalance in this story. What's interesting, John, is that on that very same day, the Wall Street Journal had a story headlined, Some Cancer Experts See Overdiagnosis and Question the Emphasis on Early Detection. They also quoted a urologist in their story, but their urologist said, we've thrown the net, here's my net analogy, very, very widely and eliminated some of the sharks, but we've also netted a lot of goldfish and assumed they'd behave the same way. So, it's whom you interview, how you frame the story, and how you end the story can really affect the take-home comprehension for readers. And I thought the Wall Street Journal did a much better job on that topic.
All right, one more story I want to ask you about. The guidelines on how often women should undergo pelvic examinations seems to be, I guess at the least you could say, controversial. And ABC News had a physician on to render her opinion on how often this should take place. What did you find in that story?
Well, what was in the news was that the American College of Physicians issued new recommendations from their panel of specialists saying that women who are at average risk and without symptoms don't benefit from pelvic exams as part of their routine care, and they face potential harms from things like false positive results. So ABC News' senior medical contributor is Dr. Jennifer Ashton, and lo and behold, she's an OBGYN. And she went on Good Morning America and said things like, it's important to see your OBGYN every year. I think that would give people some pause. And these recommendations came from internists, not OBGYNs. So what? Internists are chopped liver? they can't evaluate evidence. And on the air, on ABC World News Tonight, the anchorman led into her asking, well, what are you telling your patients tonight? My hair stands up on the back of my neck when I hear questions like that. Would they ask the political reporter, which candidate are you supporting? What makes her opinion and what she tells her patients more important than what Dr. John Schumann or any other doc, any other source would say on this topic? That's a problem. Finally, now she moved to a different medium and went on Twitter and seemed to scoff at the description of tests causing anxiety as a potential harm. She said, I agree with the first do no harm premise of medicine, but I have a problem with the paternalistic view that tests cause anxiety in women. Paternalistic? I think you could argue it's paternalistic to scoff at anxiety as a harm. I've talked with women who've had false positives. I've talked with men who've had false positives. They don't view the anxiety that they endured as something to be scoffed at. It is a real harm, and it's time we start to recognize that. So this is one of the problems with physician journalists, John, who sort of forget that they're supposed to independently vet the evidence and not give their own opinions in stories. And when we hear that, I think red flags should go up.
Red flags abound when Gary Schweitzer, publisher of healthnewsreview.org, is on the case. He's with us every week from St. Paul, Minnesota, where he reviews the week's health news. Gary, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks.
Look forward to it.
Gary Schweitzer is founder and publisher of the website healthnewsreview.org. I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters. If you work, you may find you resort to shortcuts when it comes to eating. Fast food, snack food, packaged goods that you can heat up quickly. Our guest today, John LaPuma, has devoted his career to dispelling that behavior, preferring to show both patients and the general public that better nutrition doesn't have to be difficult. With a bit of knowledge and advanced preparation, we can all learn to eat more nutritionally and subsequently drive down our personal and national health bills. More importantly, we can live our best lives. John LaPuma, welcome to Medical Matters. Tell me how you got started as a doctor who became a chef.
Well, John, as you know, I love to eat, and the closer to the source, the better. But the truth is that I was on a fast track and not paying attention to my own health, and I gained a lot of weight, and in combination with not knowing what to say to patients or how to help myself with weight problems, I decided to get off it and do something I really liked doing and wanted to do for a long time, which was to go to cooking school. And I thought that I might be able to lose the weight and keep it off if I learned to cook in a more formal way. And in fact, I was lucky enough that that happened. And when I went back to medical practice, I tried to think about and explore ways that I could use the background I'd received in cooking school and then at Topo Labombo, where I cooked on the line for almost 4 years in Chicago with Rick Bayless. And that led to a number of other exciting projects, including Chef Clinic and Real Age, so that I could actually begin to integrate the practice of medicine with the art of cooking.
Were you initially hopeful that you would be able to connect the two, or was it just sort of the circumstances of being so proximate to your medical career that being a chef and then going back was a natural segue?
Initially, it was personal. I needed to not burn out from medicine. And I needed to recover more of my sense of self because I was working 15 hours and trying to keep a lot of balls in the air at once and ignoring my own health. So it was personal. But as I went to cooking school and I met people who were as passionate about cooking as I have been about medicine and medical ethics, I found that there was overlap that I didn't expect that could be, I thought, shared with other people and generalized. So it was more kind of physician personal self-care where I tried to save my own life by doing something that was really different than what I was doing in medicine and found that I could actually help other people with what I learned.
And you really have. I mean, you've created really almost arguably an entire genre. I want to start with your most current book, Refuel, which really is aimed mostly at men, is it not?
It is. There are very few health or diet or eating books for men, unless you want to get super ripped or take a lot of pills, not all of which are legal. Yet men actually have astoundingly bad healthcare statistics compared with women. We have triple the heart attacks before the age of 55 and double before the age of 74. We die 5 years earlier, and that wasn't the case 100 years ago. We commit suicide at 4 times the rate that women do. We have more major mental illness, depression, and genetic stress disorder. We get diabetes at a lower body mass index and really bear the brunt of our physiology. And really nobody talks about it because men don't really like to talk about their health or keep any sort of sense of health, like, unless we get really sick, unless we break a leg or get sepsis or pneumonia and are forced to go to the doctor, or a spouse or partner or girlfriend or daughter makes us go to the doctor. Men don't have that kind of ethos. And so I thought, you know what? I'm a man. I'm susceptible to this stuff too. Many of my patients in my practice are men, interestingly. I need to write a book to help men learn about how their bodies work and give them food that works for them and an eating plan that actually can work. It doesn't seem like cardboard or a struggle, and can help men get back into shape, can help men not just worry about low T and say, I've got to take a drug to fix it, but actually fix it with food. Do boost the low testosterone level with what you eat, how you work out, how you sleep and handle stress. And the most interesting part of it is that this book has actually become a nightstand gift for women. That is, women buy it and leave it on a nightstand for their husband or boyfriend or partner. And they get to take it on business trips or to the office and put it in a desk drawer and then pulled out or read in a locker room. It's really, really interesting. The culture that men have around health is very different than that around women. But well, I love the letters I get, the notes I get, the emails I get, and I really love to share it even more broadly. I'd love to put this in companies and let companies use it as an employee wellness program. Otherwise, men are just taught to try to hit a cholesterol number or a blood pressure number. Those are important, but it's not something you really feel. I think that's the primary thing I've learned in all of the nutrition and cooking work that I've done blended with medicine, and that is that people respond much more, men not as overtly but just as powerfully, to how they feel instead of to data. It's great to boost your numbers, but unless you feel better, unless you have more energy, unless you get to do more of the things you want to do, unless you feel more like yourself, unless you have better sex drive or you feel physically stronger, it's very hard to motivate anyone to make changes. Unless you're fearful, unless you just had a heart attack or a stroke and you don't want to have one again. But that fearfulness is a very short-term motivator, 3 weeks, a month, 2 months. It's really powerful, positive emotion, joy, happiness, energy that gets men off the couch. And that's why I like writing Refuel. That's why I think it belongs in employee wellness programs.
All right, without spilling too many of the secrets of Refuel, what can you tell us about, men are going to want to know, listeners of this program, what they can do from a dietary standpoint to improve their testosterone without having to resort to medication?
Well, there are 4 easy fixes that every man can make to boost testosterone or to blunt estrogen in the body. And as you know, John, the spare tire you have around your belly, if you're a man, is not just a spare tire, it's actually a hormone-producing organ that converts the testosterone your testes make into estrogen, which is why guys with a big belly often have low T, because their fat is converting it into estrogen. And so citrus vegetables, broccoli, cauliflower, collard greens, turnip greens, arugula, mustard, watercress, and the like, all blunt the estrogen in the body that the testosterone is converted to, make it less potent. Oysters have enough zinc in them that they'll boost the level of testosterone in any man, especially if they're deficient in zinc. Very important manufacturing mineral, zinc is. Healthy fats, those in almonds and walnuts and macadamias and hazelnuts and all tree nuts, plus avocado and olive oil, of course, help the Leydig cells, which are the cells in your testes, make testosterone because they help the cholesterol in your liver go across that membrane so that the cells in the testicles can make testosterone better. And then, of course, vitamin D or vitamin D3-containing food boost your testosterone level if you're a man by about 15% if you raise your vitamin D level from 40 to 50 because it suppresses a protein that fancy name is sex hormone binding globulin so that you effectively make more testosterone in a short period. But the eating plan is really simple. It cuts starchy and sugary carbs because those go to your waist so quickly, and it boosts protein and fat that's good for you so that you feel full and fully satisfied. And it relies on eating more whole foods and fewer processed foods, but they're tailored for men. This is original recipes for men that men like to make and that are fun, and that women can make for them if they like or shop for them.
There was a statistic that I read somewhere where you said, of all of the research on weight loss, and I know there's been a lot, apparently only 5% focus on men in the weight loss research, but of course, half of all people with obesity are men.
That's right. Actually, men in this country overall are more obese men than there are women. And 19 out of 20 studies are done either in women or in women and men together, usually with the vast majority women, because, of course, women have been more interested in nutrition and food and dieting and eating healthy than men have. If only one out of 20 studies examined men, and we actually looked at those studies, and we did, we had our 20 pages of peer-reviewed references in the back of Refuel, we find that what men like are gender-specific targeted messages. And so in our beta test that we did and presented at Stanford and South by Southwest, we gave men specific encouraging messages, which we pepper throughout the book, to show men that they actually can get stronger, feel better, and do it in a way that is direct and business-like. Men respond best either to business-like directions. This is a problem, and this is how you fix it, and let me show you how, which is the approach that I took. Or men respond really well to humor. I love trying to be funny, but I'm not always as funny as I want to be. In fact, I'm never as funny as I want to be, so I took the more studied approach and a business-like approach of, okay, here it is, this is how you do it. It's still presented in a kind of funny way, but it's not a Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon kind of funny, and as much as I admire those guys, Jon Stewart even more.
And you mentioned the science. The book is full of the science, but it also has many recipes in the book.
I developed 15 specific recipes and did drawings for men to show them exactly how to hold a knife, to use a blender. It might sound kind of simple, but you know, I spent 4 years chopping onions in Frontera Grill, Sopo Bombo, and if you know how to use a knife and use fire really well, you actually can do almost anything. But many men just need to know how to start, and it can be as simple as holding a knife correctly to be able to fillet or slice or dice. But of course, you don't even need that if you don't want to. You can actually buy a lot of your meals or buy them prepped at the supermarket or ask your partner or girlfriend or wife or friend if she or he would help you get the ingredients that you need to eat healthy. It's very simple. I think most people make eating right harder than it has to be. And my goal in this book is to make it super simple and easy everywhere to get healthy.
So I want to shift gears for a second and talk about something that you call culinary medicine. You mentioned South by Southwest. You've appeared at, you have a TEDx talk that's available online. And I know you just recently did a TEDMed talk in San Francisco, which is not yet available, but hopefully will be very soon. What is the idea behind culinary medicine? I mean, it's really food as health?
It's actually food as prevention and therapy. It's really blending the art of cooking with the science of medicine to create restaurant-quality meals that help to prevent or treat disease. And the vision for culinary medicine is to have food on formularies, to make food a kind of a tool in a doctor's toolkit that he or she can prescribe to patients as a way of helping them with particular medical conditions, whether they have diabetes or high blood pressure or cancer or back pain or heart disease or high cholesterol or obesity, for that matter. And that vision actually is increasingly popular, not only on the more on the public side than on the insurance side. We're still knocking on the Aetna, Cigna, Blue Cross Blue Shield doors to try to begin to list meals and eating plans as available to doctors to prescribe to patients. The patients, of course, already get this. Everybody I know thinks that food belongs in a kitchen medicine cabinet and that there are foods that make you feel better and foods that make you feel worse. Foods that improve your symptoms when you have a cold and foods that make your nose run more. And so it can start that simple, but it can also be much more aggressive and much more detailed for many of the conditions that I alluded to and many more.
You also have these shorts that appear on PBS under the ChefMD short series. How did those come about?
I love PBS. I love doing television. It came about as part of a Lifetime television series I was privileged to co-host called Health Corner. We did 120 shows, and I did 120 ChefMD segments where I went food shopping for a recipe and then made the recipe. We put them online and then licensed them to PBS, where they are now showing through 2016 as shorts or interstitials. So unfortunately, you can't go to a schedule for them, but they are slotted in between regular shows on PBS nationwide. And I just love being able to teach in little nuggets, because TV and video are so lively that way. People really love the interaction, and I think it's some of the most fun I've had in medicine and food, to be able to teach on TV and to show people, hey, this isn't rocket science, and it's pretty tasty and a lot of fun.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today, Dr. John LaPuma, also known as ChefMD. He is an author, having written a number of books, including ChefMD's big book of culinary medicine. He also is the author of Cooking the Real Age Way, The Real Age Diet, and most recently, Refuel, a book aimed at health for men through nutrition and dietary science. The shorts on PBS, were those, you said they were originally on the Lifetime show and then just were sort of recut and repurposed for PBS, or did you have to do original content as well for PBS?
For those, we just recut them and repurposed them. The two PBS specials I've done on culinary medicine were original and I think have just rotated off the air. You know, this is so easy, really. If you add avocado to a spinach salad, you absorb seven times the lutein than if there was no avocado. If you sprinkle black pepper on a curry, you absorb more of the good stuff in curry, the curcumin from the turmeric, which is a strong anti-inflammatory and reduces Alzheimer's risk and stabilizes ulcerative colitis in some people. If you marinate meat, you reduce the heterocyclic amine formation, which is the carcinogenic chemical that occurs if you cook meat at a really high temperature or char them. You don't have to marinate them very long, although you might want to for flavor. If you add rosemary, it drops the HCA, or cancer-causing chemical, content by even more, because the rosemary itself is protective. If you eat yogurt with active live cultures and probiotics, they help to protect your intestine, but you have to not eat them if you're at the same time that you're taking antibiotics. You want to separate your antibiotics and your probiotics by 4 hours so the antibiotics don't kill the probiotics. If you cook pasta al dente, you lower its glycemic load. You don't make it starchy or sugary, and it takes longer for your digestion to occur. Your blood sugar doesn't rise as rapidly or sharply, and you don't get a big insulin spike and feel groggy afterwards. So undercook your pasta. And there are lots and lots more like that, where really, if you know just a little bit about food, it's this easy new approach to what you eat for that is really life-changing, because people have way more control than they think. And, of course, it's more affordable than most people imagine. So this is a way to get back into the kitchen and take your health and your food into your own hands.
So you apprenticed under Rick Bayless, you mentioned, at Frontera Grill and Topolobampo. They're fantastic restaurants in Chicago. How do chefs like Rick Bayless view your work, or are you able to impact their menus, or you know, what do you teach them about nutrition and science, or do they kind of think that you're out there and too serious as a physician scientist?
I'm privileged to do a dinner this fall in mid-November with Art Smith at Table 52 in Chicago. And Art is developing the menu, and I, from Refuel, actually, the book for men that we're talking about. And I just can't wait to see what he and his talented chefs come up with. The last thing I do is I don't try to impose anything that I might have learned on to people who already have great excellence. I mean, you know, Rick Bayless is one of the most talented chefs I know. I hope he knows something of my work, but I wouldn't expect that I could teach him really anything about food or nutrition, because Rick has a terrifically holistic view about the importance of the integration of food, culture, history, and sitting at a table and feasting that I think is not shared, sadly, by many Americans. And I do think that feasting, for example, something that we all love to do, has been kind of blown out of proportion. We miss feasting. I think we should feast, something I learned at Choclobombo, but we shouldn't feast every day. Birthday cake, it should be for your birthday, not your second cousins or your office mates or whomever, because then you kind of lose both the anticipation and the actual enjoyment, as well as the recall of pleasure, those three elements of pleasure that you should have when you have something really special like birthday cake. And if it's not a really special birthday cake, if it's an ordinary cake made with a lot of artificial ingredients that you might have bought from a grocery store section where it could have sat for 5 days before you bought it, then you ought to consider about whether you really want to eat it. One of the things that I learned from Rick was how important feasting is and how much of a sense of place, anticipation, and inner current pleasure, as well as recall pleasure, it should have instead of as an everyday event.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is John LaPuma, also known as Chef MD. He is the author of several books, including Cooking the Real Age Way, The Real Age Diet, and Chef MD's Big Book of Culinary Medicine. His newest book is Refuel, which is a book aimed at nutrition for men. The subtitle is A 24-Day Eating Plan to Shed Fat, Boost Testosterone, Pump Up Strength, and Stamina. I wanted to shift gears for a second here and ask you about a topic near and dear to my heart, physician wellness. You have written about the topic of doctors themselves and the stresses that doctors are under. In fact, you wrote a piece for the Kevin MD blog, which is, I think, one of the most widely read physician blogs in the U.S., or actually in the world. It was titled, Americans Think That Most Physicians Have It Made. They're wrong. And in it, you cite some pretty grim statistics about the level of stress that physicians are under, the high rate of suicide, the high rate of debt. And it seems like this is another foray for you into an area of concern where you want to improve the overall level of wellness. How did you come to get interested in this area?
Physician self-care kind of sounds, first of all, ought to be renamed. I don't really know what it means. But my interest in the area comes out of my observation that many of my colleagues are really tremendously talented, smart, generous people who are compassionate and really like people, but are very turned off by the practice of medicine. And, you know, as I told you, John, early on, I became disillusioned myself that I was just working way too hard and not keeping in balance other things that were important to me, including my own health and outside activities that made me more of a whole person. And so I was able to, early in my career, shift and add parts of non-traditional medicine, cooking, and even medical ethics, and then later media, that allowed me to express other parts of my personality and be more of myself and still make a contribution to patients and patient health. But a lot of my colleagues haven't been able to do that. They've been, you know, on a treadmill, as it were, working 50, 60, 70 hours a week, trying to figure out how to do a really good job in the office, but not be subject to malpractice pressures and regulation pressures and finance pressures and shifting expectations that they simply were unprepared for. And As I looked more deeply into physician health and the high rate of suicide, the high rate of burnout, the lack of recommendation from physicians to their own children about whether they should go into medicine, and tried to look at those physicians who were happiest and what sort of interventions had been done, had been tried to improve happiness in physicians, it occurred to me that that big gap in expectations between what doctors should be, particularly your own doctor, and what doctors themselves expected of their careers was so wide, that gap was so wide, that it needed, we needed to try to bridge it. And the place that I'm coming to is that if you can restore sort of something that I was lucky enough to do 20 years ago, if you can restore to physicians a sense of accomplishment and achievement that is personal and allow them, for example, to learn to cook, to learn to work out in a healthy way, to learn to meditate if that's what they like, to learn to write if that's what they like, to learn to woodwork if that's what they like, to basically help them with lifestyle and wellness as a person, kind of as well-being, and you make that part of their job, you make the well-being excellence part of their job where the only parameter that they have to be measured by is their own, then I think, and this has been tried for in some environments for just an hour a week where docs could do basically anything they like but not receive expert instruction if they wanted it. You can improve well-being, you can improve productivity, you can improve morale, and then I hope, although I don't know that that's been demonstrated, improve patient care. What we do know is that doctors who exercise write exercise prescriptions more often. Doctors who wear seatbelts write seatbelt prescriptions more often. Doctors who cook or have had a short cooking intervention counsel patients on obesity who are obese more often. So we know doctors who've quit smoking are more likely to suggest a smoking, anti-smoking intervention to their patients who still smoke than those who continue to smoke. So we know that physician care, self-care that is healthy, is reflected in patient care that is better in a number of ways. And I'm really curious about what would happen if we tried distinctly to improve morale and capability by improving personal wellness and lifestyle among physicians who are just about to burn out, as so many primary care docs are.
You write about having taught courses or sessions with healthcare providers in cooking and in farming demos. Who are your audiences for that, or how do you find them? And then, I mean, you've already talked about the theme, but I mean, do they go away from one session feeling transformed, or is it a number of sessions that they undergo?
I haven't been able to do it as much as I'd wanted, but generally people find me. Kaiser Permanente asked me to do a postgraduate medical education course in wellness with 50 physicians who really are starting where we're all starting, in cooking or in farming or gardening, not really knowing, with a few exceptions for those people with already an outside passion and they've taken the time to develop expertise in it. But the vast majority of docs don't really know. I mean, they know that broccoli doesn't come from a package, but they don't really know why it's a powerful cruciferous vegetable and how that's related to how it grows, or why, for example, cooking it takes away the goitrogens, the parts of broccoli that disturb the thyroid, or why lightly cooking it or eating it raw preserves the cancer-fighting parts of broccoli, or how that's reflected in how you care for when it grows, what it looks like when it grows, and why young broccoli has now been developed as an extract by scientists at Johns Hopkins who are using it for patients with chronic lung disease to try to clear their lung disease that's been worsened by environmental pollutants and allergens, which is apparently doing effectively. So in linking all of these various strands, physicians I've taught become really curious about not just how to choose broccoli and how, why it's so different than young broccoli, it's so different than old broccoli, but also how they might better their own families and lives with that knowledge and how they might bring it back to clinic. So when I've been privileged to teach these courses, it's usually by invitation, it's always by invitation, really. And it starts with a kind of self-discovery about the things that matter. Doctors like the idea of writing recipes on prescription slips, but they don't quite know how to do it. They certainly don't know whether they'll get paid for it and how they'll measure whether it makes a difference. And I think that measuring making a difference is the most critical part of making sure that we're doing good and that we're speaking the language that patients want to speak with us. So it's a new area, I think, but it's a really fertile one, and one that has tremendous potential for helping our healthcare system where we're so dependent on primary care physicians and where we have so few of them and we're losing them so rapidly. Restoring that morale, improving people's own sense of wellness and well-being, I think will have not just the effect of reclaiming the mission of medicine, but also sharing that sense of self and that sense of achievement with patients and with self-care for patients themselves. So I'm excited about exploring it.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a vision. I mean, it's one that I could certainly get behind and be excited about. Do you foresee under healthcare reform or new paradigms of healthcare delivery, nutrition and, you know, health science, nutrient science being a broader part of the tool chest of doctors and other, you know, healthcare practitioners? Or do you see it as more of a grassroots movement, you know, from patients themselves as consumers become, patients become more savvy about healthcare?
The food as medicine movement is primarily among patients. Patients believe, the people who write to me, watch my TV stuff and buy my books and are part of our newsletter are really interested in food as medicine and using food as medicine. People are curious about what's in their food. They want their food to be better, cleaner, less polluted, better for them. They want their food to work better for them, too. So I think that the impetus for a culinary medicine kind of specialty or specialty interest is going to come even more from patients than it is from the profession or professions, including nursing and dietetics and physician assistants and more. But I think self-care, that is the improvement of physicians and clinicians' own health with lifestyle measures, is going to be clinician-driven because patients are largely unaware that clinicians are burned out, first of all. And secondly, because there's already a movement in lifestyle medicine to create a certificate through the American College of Preventive Medicine because Tulane's new curriculum in culinary medicine has been licensed to 8 medical schools, and there are at least half a dozen more that have culinary medicine on their plate. There are Lifestyle Institute at Harvard that has done terrific CME work. There are many other, the Healthy Kitchen, Healthy Lives course, also partnership between the Culinary Institute of America and Harvard School of Medicine has been ongoing for 7 years to rave reviews. I think there's a lot of room, and at the moment, what we ought to do is let a thousand flowers bloom, because food really is the most powerful healthcare intervention we have, and it's sustainable. Food is sustainable. It's fun. It has meaning. It treats the cause, not the symptoms, and it strengthens your power to care for others. Prescriptions for hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, thyroid problems are not sustainable. Usually not sustainable anyway. They are often cost-dependent or finances-dependent. They have adverse effects that are often unrecognized. And although people may really need their prescriptions, and we do need medications for sick care, it is entirely possible to control about 80% of chronic disease with lifestyle measures. And the more that we get that into the mainstream, the more that we try different protocols for helping people control their own health with what they eat, how they live, the more that we don't make people read entire medical textbooks, but make it simple for them, as I've tried to do with Refuel and ChefMD, and so many others are doing as well, I think the more success we'll have. If people catch themselves doing something right and replace bad habits and begin to believe it's not the hand that they're dealt, it's how they play it, then we'll be doing our jobs as clinicians. And that job, I think, is empowering patients to take care of themselves.
Well, John LaPuma, that is a powerful thought, that you know, 80% can be dealt with through lifestyle changes. I think that's as positive a place as any that we could end on. I want to thank you so much for chatting with us today. John LaPuma is a physician. He's a board-certified internist. He's also a professionally trained chef who apprenticed under the great Chicago chef Rick Bayless. He is known as Chef MD. His most recent book is called Refuel, among several others that he's written. John LaPuma, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
John LaPuma is the author of three cookbooks, the most recent of which is Refuel. He's a chef and doctor practicing in Santa Barbara, California. His nutrition information segments, Chef MD Shorts, are currently airing on PBS stations across the country. You can find out more about him at his website, drjohnlapuma.com. Listening to Medical Matters. For comments or questions about the program, drop me an email, schumann.john@gmail.com. That's S-C-H-U-M-A-N-N. And now, commentator Janet Pearson offers us this meditation on a condition that affects nearly all of us, worry.
Mad Magazine cover boy Alfred E. Newman famously asked, "What, me worry?" To which I would reply, "Well, yeah, doesn't everybody? It's part and parcel of the human condition." There are so many references to worry in literature and history and culture that we have to assume humankind must have always been plagued by this problem. Mark Twain had a characteristically clever take on the problem, one that could be useful to most of us today if we take it to heart. "I am an old man and have known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened." Singer Bobby McFerrin had a simpler take on the problem in his runaway hit song, "Don't Worry, Be Happy." Ah, if only it were that easy. In my never-ending quest to conquer worry, I sometimes read fun stuff, like Ernie Zelinsky's The Joy of Not Working. But even he gets serious when it comes to the subject of worry. He found a Pennsylvania State University study that he says shows that 15% of the U.S. population spends at least 50% of each day worrying. Other research he dug up shows that worrying is so rampant that approximately one out of three North Americans has serious mental problems as a result. "Some people are so used to worrying that they worry if they don't have anything to worry about," he notes. Sound like anyone you know? Zelinsky also came up with some research that dramatically illustrates just how worthless worrying is. Here's his summary. 40% of worries are about events that will never happen. 30% of worries are about events that have already happened. 22% of worries are about trivial events, 4% are about events we cannot change, and only 4% of worries are about real events we could do something about. In case you don't have enough stuff to worry about, Zelinsky's got some ideas for you. You might, for example, worry about what to wear if you're ever invited to be a guest on Oprah. You could worry about who you might be reincarnated as. How about what type of car to buy if you win the lottery? You could fret about whether or not your purpose in life is to be a warning for others, or, if you're a perfectionist, a lot of worriers are, you could worry about whether or not you can have a paradigm shift. All joking aside, worrying is no laughing matter for millions of Americans. The Anxiety and Depression Association of America estimates that more than 40 million American adults have an anxiety disorder, a condition that often results from excessive worrying. These disorders cost the U.S. more than $42 billion, that's billion with a B, a year. About $23 billion of that cost is associated with the repeated use of healthcare services by people whose anxiety problems show up as a physical illness. People with anxiety disorders are 3 to 5 times more likely to go to the doctor and 6 times more likely to be hospitalized for a psychiatric problem. The list of physical problems linked to worry and stress and anxiety is endless. Headaches, chronic pain, insomnia, digestive disorders, fibromyalgia, coronary artery disease, suppression of the immune system, even heart attacks. I think these people have been reading my mail. It's tough to persuade veteran warriors that it doesn't have to be this way. There are many proven steps that can be very helpful. Aerobic exercise, proper nutrition, therapy, meditation, breathing, and relaxation techniques. Even something as simple as snapping a rubber band on your wrist to snap you out of the worry mode is helpful for some people. But for some reason, lots of us don't do what's necessary to get our worrying under control. I figure that's got to be because of some personality defect or lack of discipline or other deep-down psychological problem we aren't even aware of yet. Great. Something else to worry about.
Janet Pearson, a Tulsan, was a print journalist for nearly four decades. She's now branching into other forms of media. Medical Matters is produced at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. Scott Gregory produced and edited today's show. Music for the show is created by Scott Griffith. Our theme music is by Europa 51. I'm John Schumann. Join us next week for another edition of Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition.